Learn to run like a boss. Like a boss. Want to increase your speed and improve your endurance? You're about to get the training, nutrition, race strategy, and overall optimal performance advice to help you become a lion. This is Run Collo Training. Here's your hosts, Tristan Mitchell and Simon Escorcia.
Hello and welcome to the Run Collo Training podcast. Today our guest is Coach Jenny Hadfield. Welcome, Jenny.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Hey, we're doing well. How are things going for you?
Things are going great. I'm out in Chicago, and Okay. We've already got some cooler weather, so it's nice. Great for running, great for trail running.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess this is kind of start off, if you can tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, kind of how you got into running, and then your coaching, and then, you know, maybe some of the books that you've written, and your weekly column, or your column in Runner's World as well.
Sure. I'm going to be honest right up front. I used to hate running, hated it. I grew up playing team sports. So okay. I started with Chicago. So I was about 7 years old, knee high to a grasshopper, and the ball was as big as my head. And then I got into volleyball and basketball. So I was a team sports player. And when we'd be coached, running was always a form of punishment. So if you missed a volleyball serve, you had to go. I had to go run those darn suicide drills, and it was always with pain because it wasn't properly introduced to it. And it wasn't until I was doing an internship at GE Medical Systems up in Wisconsin for exercise science. It was a corporate fitness center. And I walked in, and I was about 35 pounds heavier than I am right now, and all of the employees at the corporate fitness center were runners, which immediately I thought, oh my gosh, completely intimidating. Super nice folks, and the first thing that they said was, okay, we're going to have a team challenge, and this fall, we're going to run a 5K. And I thought, there's no way I'm running a 5K. No way. I will, you know, do your filing, I'll clean the bathrooms, whatever you want, but I'm not going to run. And so they challenged me. I accepted the challenge. They convinced me. But more importantly, they helped me train. And this was 20-plus years ago. When there wasn't a Google, there wasn't an internet, they got together, there were five of us, and they got together with me, and every other day at lunchtime, we started with walking, and I thought, oh, I can do walking, and then they sprinkled in running a little bit, 15 seconds, 30 seconds, intervals, and by the end of that summer, slowly and surely, we were all training together, I was able to run that 5K, and it changed my life forever. So I spent about 10 years in corporate fitness. I used to be the director of the Corporate Fitness Center for Discover Card up north.
Okay.
And along the way, I got bitten by a long-distance running bug. So I started doing 10Ks and half marathons and ultra runs and adventure races. And truly, I fell in love with the process of training, but more importantly, coaching and helping people. You know, employees would come into my office and say, hey, I want to run a marathon. Again, this is the 90s, so marathoning, you know, the Chicago Marathon had 4,000 people back, and now it's 45,000. So it wasn't what it was now. There wasn't the information out on the internet. So they would come in and say, hey, I want an everyday mortals plan. I've got family. I've got work. I need to be able to train. Can you put together a training plan for me? And that's truly where it started. From there, I quit my corporate job and started a marathon and half marathon and running club coaching program, which eventually led into building Chicago Endurance Sports with my partner, Mike Norman. And from there, it just kind of everything started coming towards me, you know, opportunities. The Indy Mini Marathon, I worked with them, and that's kind of how I started learning how to write because – again, it wasn't really the internet. We put my training plans up on the website for the race, and that was a big darn deal to have a training plan up on a website, you know? And then they would send out emails to all the participants. There were 30,000 participants, so every week they'd send this email out with weekly tips and then ask Coach Jenny a link to my email. So I would just sit and hammer and answer question after question after question. And that led to the other opportunities with Runner's World and the Ask Coach Jenny column that I write weekly, certainly working with my husband and writing our two books, Running for Mortals and Marathoning for Mortals. So truly, all of this has stemmed from my passion for the community of running, helping runners, but also you know, the passion that I found from other runners helping me.
That is really cool, Jenny. That's I can relate to that in a big way, just because I was my path to running was similar to a certain degree. I grew up playing team sports, and when I got into it, I lost about 50 pounds when I first got into it. So I can totally relate to that. And it was, I ran one 10K that my dad convinced me to do, and next thing I knew, a year later, I was running my first marathon and in love with it. So I can totally relate to that. So that was awesome. I actually, when reading about you last night online, I totally was like, this is such a great story. This is so, like, I could, like I said, the relatability is awesome. Can you tell us a little bit, Jenny, like when you started, you said that, you know, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have that stuff. You had coworkers coming to you, things like that. Was a lot of that kind of like trial by error training in those days for you? How did you have, obviously you had guidance from other coworkers and stuff, but was it kind of like, man, I'm going to go give this a shot and see what happens kind of thing?
There was a ton of trial and error. And again, that's, I've learned the most from the people that I've coached through the years. But again, back then, 93-ish, when all this was happening, early 90s, when all this was happening in my life, I learned the most about getting started from those five people that were already runners. And they didn't say, hey, we're going to go, you know, test out 5 miles. Let's take it to the track and intimidate the heck out of me. They really, the truth of, and this is, goes back to the foundation of my philosophy. They started from where I was, which was overweight, out of shape. You know, I had fun in college and I wasn't fit at the time. And they said, okay, we're going to start with walking. And the secret to that was I got done with that first walking workout and felt fantastic. You know, I felt happy, and that led me to do it again and again and again. So I think those five people truly taught me so much about how to get started and how to help people from the point of where they are, really identifying where that is, and then slowly progressing. Because at the time, there were, you know, great folks like Hal Higdon and Jeff Galloway, and, you know, their plans at the time were for classic runners, where high mileage, you know, high mileage during the week. And the folks that I was working with at the time didn't have time for a 10-mile run on a Wednesday. It was just a completely different population of people. So it was really sitting down with folks one-on-one and really understanding the everyday mortal's life, in that they wanted to weave running into their lifestyle, but not necessarily make it their whole lifestyle.
Absolutely. Sure. Jenny, you know, kind of staying on this topic, I guess, you know, going back to early to mid-90s and your training thoughts then, fast forward 20 years, what are some things that you have, I guess, discovered that you know that don't work or that you're incorporating now that you used to, things that you've kind of scrapped along the way? I mean, you know, you kind of brought up the long runs and the high mileage, and that's something, you know, both Tristan and I, we're competitive runners, and we're kind of experimenting that with ourselves. I'm like, you know, last year I was running 90 miles a week in preparation for a marathon. This year I found, I'm like, if I stick to 70, my workouts are better, I feel better. And, you know, just kind of that self-experimenting. So, yeah. So what have you found in those 20 years of training that tend to work for, you know, those rookie runners?
Such a great question. I love this question. Truly, there's two core areas. One, cross training. You got to remember, I came from a fitness background. I didn't come from a running background. So had I come from, you know, track and all of that stuff, my thought process would have been very similar to that, and I would have gone into a high mileage mode. My thought process came from strength and flexibility and group exercise classes. I mean, low impact aerobics. Aerobics and indoor cycling. And what I was seeing, what I was working with, is weaving in cross training back then into a running program, which you didn't see anything about that. It was like, you never stretch, you never do strength training. I mean, even with basketball players, they didn't do strength training because they didn't want to, you know, offset their throw, their layup, or whatever. So that was a key for everyday mortals, and now you're starting to see it more and more with guys like you who are at the front end, the sharp end of the pack, that are weaving in all these cross-training principles and running with a lower volume but higher quality miles. Mm-hmm. Same thing is true for the everyday mortal. It's weaving in the cross-training, not necessarily all high quality miles, but just to allow their bodies to adapt and recover because their lives are so crazy busy. And mechanically, they may have some offsets as well. So that's a biggie. And then the second thing I would say is effort-based training, not only heart rate training, which we've come a long way with in simplifying, but also just, it's really been interesting. If you look at elite athletes like Frank Shorter and Joan Benoit Samuelson, who've been really successful in their careers and still, look at Joan, she's still running sub 3-hour marathons. It's incredible, in her mid-50s. They learned how to train and race by the tune of their body, right? It wasn't necessarily all pace-based. It was really, you had a Timex watch, which was digital. If you were lucky, you had 10 laps on it, and you went out and you had to know where those mile markers were. You got in your car and you drove the mile markers and knew where those split were. You head to a track, right? We didn't have all the technology that we have today. And in the transition in the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years, as all these gadgets have moved in, GPS watches and speed distance monitors, fantastic technology, but what it's done to the average runner is to teach them how to run by a number, by pace, and they're totally turning off what's going on in their body. And my biggest philosophy is to kind of shift back and go retro with that, use the technology, but let it be the outcome. And an example of that is, you know, someone who's going to go out and do a long training run. Let's say they're going to do a 10 or 12 mile run. For someone like you, you guys know your paces to a T. So if it's hot out there, if it's a humid day, you know, okay, I need to back off 15 seconds per mile. The everyday runner is not going to understand all those little intricate tweaks. So it's really more important to go out and say, okay, today I'm going to back off, listen to my breath, tune into my heart rate monitor, and figure out, you know, what my body is feeling on the given day. I might be fantastic. It might be nice and cool like it is in Chicago today. You might be able to run a little bit faster and still stay in that long, easy, conversational effort level. But if it's a hot day and it's humid, that pace is going to change. So you see, I see a lot of runners now just going by pace, going by calculations. I'm going to go by an estimated, you know, I did a 10K 4 weeks ago, and now I'm going to go out by this calculated pace, but it's a hot day, and they go out and they're running at that red line, and they're running beyond their threshold, and now they've turned this easy run into a really hard run. They have a hard time finishing. It affects the length of their recovery. It takes them a week to recover instead of a couple of days. And it's this ongoing process of overtraining or overreaching, as we like to say. So I think the other big thing that I've seen is the going from tuning into your body and really being mindful of your breath and being mindful of where your effort level is. And then also going, like, transitioning to, okay, I'm going to watch this. I remember the first GPS watch. I can't remember the name of it, but it kind of looked like a Star Trek watch. And then there was the brick by Garmin and all of that stuff. So we went into that phase, and it was unbelievable that you could see every single step, the pace that was going, oh my God, this is incredible. And so now there's this focus on this number. And now we're transitioning back into, okay, this is a number, this is the outcome, what's going on in my body? And that's kind of the work that I'm doing with Pair Sports, which is a free app, but it's audio coaching. It's the first audio coaching app that allows real coaches like me and Matt Fitzgerald to coach you on every single step of the way based on what's going on in your body via heart rate. So it's really fantastic what's going on with technology.
That's very cool. I definitely want to hear a little bit more about that for sure. But before we go there, do you take some of the technology away from some of your people sometimes if they can't listen to their bodies? Because I feel like so many people become obsessed with, you know, and we can be guilty of this too sometimes, where, you know, we'll go out after a track, you know, the day after a track workout, and probably, you know, find ourselves 5 miles in and we're running 20 seconds a mile faster than we really should be running. But, you know, you kind of get locked into what your Garmin's saying and what your Garmin usually says, and it's very easy to kind of be fooled by that. I think heart rate monitors in particular, you can just have people, you know, you're going to wear your heart rate monitor, but I don't want you worrying about what your splits are, kind of thing. You know, do you take some of that technology away from some people if they cannot kind of lose the OCD of, I need to run this pace?
Yes. And I'm in that category of people, I'll have you know.
I put it out there to my readers. I put it out to my coaching clients. I will recommend that you go out and learn first how to run by your body, and then add in that technology. Even to turn the watch around, if you're carrying a camelback, put it in the camel pack, put it in a have it with you so you have the stats and the data, but don't look down to see where you're at. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One, you just mentioned, you get into that number and you get excited and you want to push. But the opposite of that is true as well. And I'll tell you a quick story. I work with the Cleveland Marathon. I'm their training consultant and coach. And I was speaking at their events. It's in May at the expo. And I always put out this timeless challenge in spring and fall for marathoners and half marathoners to try and run a race. It could be a lead up race, like a 10K. Or it could be the race, depending on how risky they want to be, and just run the events without any technology and by the tune of their body. So by their breathing rates, and then just pace it out based on what's going on in their body. So I put this timeless challenge out, and this back at the expo, I'm speaking and I'm talking about effort-based training and, you know, tips for race day. And there's a girl that comes up after the expo and says, I took timeless challenge, and she was walking out of the house to go to the race and dropped her watch and it broke. It froze and she wasn't able to reboot it and use it, so she left it at home. She ended up doing the timeless challenge, and what she said was she looked at her splits after the race and it was so fast that her mind couldn't have imagined running that fast. So that's the opposite side of that, that you get out there and then you look down and it's slow and you go, oh my gosh, I'm slow, I stink, this is awful, I'm never going to make my PR. And then you look down and you go, oh, I'm fast, there's no way I can do this, it's running way beyond my capabilities. So it's a mind game. You start associating this number with how you should be and where you should be, and I should be at 9 minute split now, and now I should be at 9:05s, and around this corner I'm going to slow it down. It doesn't work like that. I mean, it just doesn't work like that. It's all based on what's going on in your body. And we can run so much faster than we think we can. So it's really a matter of kind of removing all those mental barriers and those fears and those anxieties or the motivations that come with a number or reaching for a number, and really just going back to the basics of what is my body feeling on today.
I so agree with that. That's another story that I can relate to for sure. The first time, a couple of years back, when I first broke 5:30s over 10-mile distance, and I just didn't believe in myself at all. Didn't believe that I could do it. And I remember being 2 miles in and looking down at my watch and running like a 5:25 or something, being like, "Holy crap! Like, this is my day." Yes. And I remember, like, just I flipped my watch, I turned it around on my wrist, and I didn't look down at it until like the 9th mile, and then I was still on pace. And I told my dad afterwards, I was like, I just needed to not think. If I did, you know, I got out of my own head, and that's so hard to do as runners, isn't it? I mean, we're so in our own heads all the time, I feel like, and it was difficult, and it's something. It's hard, to be honest. It's been hard for me to replicate in another race, but. For whatever reason, that day I was able to do it, and you're so right. I mean, I just think sometimes you just gotta go. You just gotta run. Sometimes it's good for you. So, anyways,
yeah. I mean,
go ahead.
The opposite of that too. I mean, you could have a magical day where all the planets are in alignment and things just happen, and you can have a day where, you know, a couple of years ago with the Chicago Marathon, and it's 90 degrees and it's awful, and if you're going after a pace and you set that mark on a pace, you're going to crash and burn at mile 15. So it's, again, it's on both ends of the spectrum, just teaching runners that every finish line is a gift, number one, and that go with what the day gives you. You know, go with, it could be a PR day. It could be a day where you still finish strong and you're 20 minutes slower because it's so hot outside. But in both case scenarios, the goal is to finish strong.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Jenny, to kind of piggyback on my last question, you know, within the last 20 years, have your thoughts changed at all with regards to nutrition? And, you know, kind of specifically, I'm thinking, you know, like Tim Noakes coming out and changing his opinion that runners don't need a high carbohydrate hydrate, diet, and so have your thoughts changed in the last 20 years, like you personally and your clients you coach?
Absolutely. And I will say this up front that I'm not a nutritional expert or scientist. I mean, I give very, very general tips on nutrition. It's mostly wrapped around performance via versus diet. But again, it's very similar to what's going on with technology in that if you look back years ago, even in the 70s, although that's a little extreme because they never drank water back then, it was considered a weakness. But you start looking at the 80s and 90s in terms of performance, and Gatorade was introduced, so liquid fuel, liquid energy, electrolytes, we learned about that. When I was racing and competing back in the 90s, really it was, you had for a marathon, let's just talk marathon distance. There was Gatorade, there was water, and the latest and greatest was plain goo gel. That was it. Sure. That was it. You know, it was very, very simple. You used Gatorade. You figured out what ratio of Gatorade. Some people could do Gatorade every aid station. Some people could do Gatorade and or water and alternate. And on 18 or 19 or 20, when you started to, you look at the simplicity of that and where we are right now, it's mind blowing. It's mind blowing. It's confusing for people because there's so many products. It's like the cereal aisle. You, if you walked down an aisle in the grocery store and looked at blocks and bars and gels and combination of gels and blocks and sports drinks, and it's so confusing to the everyday person. I think folks that are up at the sharp end understand which products work well with them. But I think where we are right now is, A, it's really fascinating that it's coming down to what works for you. So again, tuning back into your body, what works for you guys might not work for me. There's metabolic typing where we look at how your body digests foods. I might be more of a higher carbohydrate person. You might be more better off with a moderate amount of 40-30-30. Everybody's different. So that gives us the opportunity to kind of look at, okay, how does my body feel when I'm doing a ton of carbohydrates versus doing maybe a 40-30-30 percentage? How do I feel in that? And you're going to feel differently than I am. But then also really tying back into getting all of the artificial sweeteners out and the synthetic foods and going back to where we were before with really clean foods. So again, we've gone from a simple place, you know, using that digital watch, using one gel and maybe a sports drink to craziness. There's products all over the place, which is great because we learn so much from new products, to really tuning it, fine tuning it into the actual person and or gender. I don't know if you've talked to Dr. Stacy Sims yet. She is a nutritional researcher with Stanford. She's done a considerable amount of research on gender-specific nutrition. Fascinating stuff. What works for a female's body doesn't necessarily work for males and vice versa. So I think for the female running contingency and community, it's really enlightening because all the research and all of the products that have been created for the most part have been geared towards science on the male body. So, and you know us, we're complicated and we're cycling and we've got hormonal fluctuations. So there's so many things that go into play on that. But it's really, really fascinating stuff. And just to speak to the hydration, again, it's the same evolution. We went from simplicity and drinking to thirst to drinking to a specific ounce amount, general recommendations every 15 to 20 minutes, you know, 8 to 12 ounces. How often did we say that, right? 10 years ago. And now, again, based on research, we look at some people that's too much. Other people might be not be enough. There's a certain amount of fluids that we can digest as human beings, and it's different for you and I. To simplicity, again, to drinking by thirst, using a sports drink, those types of things. So it's, I think we just fluctuate, but on that evolution, on that journey, we've learned so much about the individual athlete. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I do really think that is such a good point, that nutrition is so, just like, you know, a proper training protocol, nutrition truly is so individualized you know, and in a lot of ways, general guidelines are the best way to go, and people kind of need to experiment with themselves, what works, what doesn't. Jenny, what are your thoughts on, Simon and I are always interested in footwear, running footwear in particular. What are your thoughts on minimalist shoes versus, you know, kind of the maximalist shoes and everything in between? Do you put much thought into what your clients are wearing footwear wise and what their form's looking like? I'm sure you do, obviously.
I do. Another fantastic question. And again, trends come and go. I mean, all of these things are in the same evolutionary cycle. I go a lot by the information that I receive from people via emails, on Facebook, people that I meet at expos. So I'm learning from the population. It's not technically research, but it's information on what's working with lots of different people, lots of different categories of runners. And there are trends that happen. And so if I have one person tell me something happens, it's one person. But if I start to see, you know, hundreds of people emailing me about issues, then the distance between, or the width, height of the shoe from the heel of the toe, whatever. So it was more of a low profile, what you're seeing now in the minimalist category. Then we went into the Nike craze where there were, remember those shock things? I mean, they looked like spikes almost on the bottom of your heel, and our, they were off the ground. I thought they were the coolest thing. I mean, I couldn't wait to put those shoes on and run around the block. But seriously, the heel was like my heel. Yeah, it was unbelievable. And again, high drop, high distance height from the heel to the toe, which, again, as we know, we've learned that that affects your gait. It teaches people how to run, makes people run differently. You know, landing with that cushion on your heel, which sounds like a great thing, but it can increase the impact on your body, as we're learning now, and as we've learned through the Born to Run book. And so now, you know, the shoe industry is moving more towards removing that heel, making it more, not necessarily zero drop or barefoot or nothing, but we're seeing more lower traditional 70s style shoes where you might have a 4 to 6 millimeter drop, which is more on the minimalist. It's not zero drop, but category down to zero, and including lots of like the Hokas, the high volume cushion. So you've got this cushion now in a Hoka shoe. You've got the rocker style, which is kind of like the Skechers shoe, right? Which we used to laugh at, right? Mm-hmm. So now, you know, the shoe, it helps transition you forward. You've got this big marshmallow cushion, but it combines the cushion and the rocker with the more of a minimalist 4 to 6 millimeter drop, which is really interesting, really interesting. So I've got a lot of folks that are emailing me and writing me about transitioning from a traditional shoe with a higher heel to more of a minimalist and or zero drop. 5 years ago, people were trying to go to zero. 4 years ago, people were trying to go to zero, nothing from the high heel, tons of injuries. Yeah. Now we're seeing more options in shoes where it might be an 8 millimeter drop, it might be a 6 millimeter drop, so you can transition down a little bit more and remove that heel height. But again, what I'm seeing on my end is there are a smaller percentage of people that can do this without fail, without injury, but the higher percentage of my peeps, everyday mortals, are getting injuries. And injuries in calves, Achilles, foot problems, not necessarily because of the shoe, but the transition into that shoe isn't slow enough. And the fundamental reason for that is we're all training for long distance races, right? We're training for halves, we're training for fulls, now we're training for ultras. Really popular. It's not popular now, I think it will be in a couple of years, to run a 5K or a 10K. everybody wants to run these long distance races. So they're in a constant mode of training and training long. So to take a shoe and they think, I'm going to do this slowly, I'm going to only run 3 miles in this shoe, and that's a slow transition. It's not a slow transition. So I think there's still a loss in translation of how to transition into a shoe. More importantly, how to help your body adapt from being in an elevated state and learning to run on that heel and have that cushion there for you, to learning how to activate your calves and your soleus muscles so that you have that dynamic landing, so those muscles are activated and you're taking the pressure off and the impact off of your body. I think there's a disconnect or loss in translation about how slowly that process truly needs to be. For some people, it could be a year or two, depending on how long they've been running, depending on what they have going on biomechanically, depending on the running gait, and depending on how quickly they learn to run with that new style, which is more of a mid to forefront landing. So I think we're in a really interesting place. I think it's important for people to be mindful of that these shoes are, again, going back to where we came from with some additional research and technology, which is great, and assistance, which is great, like the Hokas. But you still need to understand that we've been in a supported, in many cases for women, our heels have been elevated in shoes for years and years and years, and your muscles and your calves and your all the way up the kinetic chain are used to that. So you almost need to undo that and then relearn how to run in this shoe before you can go out and do a 3 mile run or a half marathon or a marathon. Because if you make that transition too quickly, it'll be great for 2 weeks, and then 2 months down the road, you're going to, why are my calves hurting? Why is my Achilles, ruptured? Those types of things. So you just need to be really, really cautious in the process.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. And I think one of the things that I think one of our frustrations in general with shoe companies is the fact that, we have kids, you can't find a minimalist pair of shoes, for kids. They're put into high heeled shoes right out of the gate, essentially. And we're breaking them from, from the start. And then, and now you have adults trying to kind of relearn how to move correctly. And it's a slow, long process. I think one of the things too is that people jump into these minimalist shoes, they run for an hour in a minimalist shoe, and then they walk around, in high heels or, a traditional high heeled, suit shoe of some sort for a male, whatever it may be. And next thing and then they wonder why they can't adapt to it. And it's like, well, you spend the vast majority of your time in a high heeled shoe, 1 hour of running, think of the shock on the system, on the body right there. So, I'd love to see shoe companies kind of get into the minimalist game even more, and I think you brought up a great point with the transition. I've struggled for a while now trying to transition. When Simon and I first started, when we first met years ago, I used to run with 2 heel wedges in my shoes because I dealt with Achilles tendonitis early on in my running years. And he would always make fun of me. I mean, I have my heels so far off the ground, and he, slowly over time convinced me to get out of that. But it took a long, long time just to lose the wedges, let alone to get into like a more low drop shoe. And I'm nowhere near, I can't run in a shoe that he can run in. To this day, I'm still not close to it. But it's a long process, but one that's worth it, in my opinion, for sure. Are you ready?
Oh. Jenny, one of the reasons I was excited to have you on is, I think it's fair to say.
Absolutely. You guys are at the back.
I think it's fair to say that the coaching world is dominated by males. So, I wanted to get the perspective from a female coach and, maybe kind of a two-part question here. One, do you think there's any advantage just of being a female coach that you see things that a lot of male coaches kind of overlook? And two, just working with female clients, because I can tell you one thing that I personally struggle with is, with some of the female clients that we coach is, I've never really had to deal with kind of the emotional issues that come with running that a lot of female runners do, where they're intimidated to race, they have, all of these other kind of emotional stuff where, you know, for the life of me, since I was 14, I'm, oh yeah, let's race. You know, I'm fired up and I'm ready to go. And I couldn't even think mentally. I'm like, how could you be afraid to race, or how could you not want to race? You know, I wanted to race all the time. And for me, that was a huge part of the reason that kept me motivated to train. So yeah, I guess kind of two-part question, coaching as a female, and then just working with female clients and how they differ so much from working with your male clients.
Sure. Again, great question. It's a Mars and Venus thing. You know, it goes back to Dr. Sims' work, my work with training plan, female-specific training plans, which I'm doing more and more work with these days as the research comes out and showing us we are different, you know. We're the same in terms of taking right, left, but even anatomically we're different. Metabolically, we're different. Hormonally, we're different. Coming into the space, the coaching space, there weren't any. I mean, I think regionally, locally, there were cross-country coaches and track coaches and that kind of thing, but not at the level where it might be mass market, where the information's coming out from a female's voice, which was really both intimidating to me because I in my early years, in my 30s, I would always second guess, gosh, am I right? Because this is what everybody else is doing, but this is what I'm feeling. And in my body, it doesn't seem right. And I'm seeing differences between men. And it wasn't until I hit my 40s and I really got the confidence and really under helpful for me in terms of how I coach both men and women. I learned the difference between men and women when I was racing adventure races, eco challenges, where we would be out, you know, in the middle of the boondocks in Fiji racing nonstop for 9 days. And there's three guys on my team and there's me. And the interesting part of all that is we all respond differently to racing performance days and training and adaptations. And here was a perfect example, because you had to have both genders represented in these races, of A, how they race together, but the differences between emotionally how I might respond. I might break down when I had... when we were climbing in up a muddy hill on a rope and there were red ants going all over me, biting me, I broke down and started crying. And my teammates were like, oh my God, she's crying, you know. But for a male, it's hard for a male, I think, to release that same emotional response via crying. I think he would be made fun of.
Except for Simon. Cries all the time.
I'm just kidding.
And that's okay. There's no crying in money, right? So, I mean, I think I learned via a lot of racing, a lot of training from the guys on my team. It was really, really interesting. The teams that did really well together came to a kind of a center line of their gender. In other words, I really kind of needed to tap into my masculine side and they needed to be able to tap into their feminine side, because we all have masculine and feminine. And if you could get everybody to kind of come to that medium line where they were both comfortable, both masculine and feminine energy, you couldn't stop a team that had that going for them. So long story short, I could tell stories about adventure racing all day. That's a whole different podcast. I think working with female athletes it's different. You know, it's different. Once we start cycling, and I'll get a little personal here, I apologize. Once we start cycling post-puberty, our lives completely change. Up until that point, we're pretty much the same. Our hormonal systems are pretty much the same as yours, but once we hit that magical point in the center core of our lives, every day for us is different. Every single day. And you see a lot of jokes and stories, and we make fun of it ourselves. And I think where we need to move forward is really understanding what's going on in the female body while that's happening. It's unique for me. It's also unique for everyone else. But understanding that hormonal process and the cycling, so we can train specifically to that, but also understanding there's a reason why we cry. There's a reason why we get emotional. There's a reason why we feel like we need to be connected to other females. It's all related to that hormonal cycle, that 28 or 30-day cycle where There's Wonder Woman days where we're feeling like, poo-hoo, you know, we could do anything, and we can do anything. Our heart rates are lower, our body temperatures are lower. And then the 180 of that is the time where we really need to nestle and nurture ourselves and take care of ourselves and not make fun of ourselves, and understanding that that's where we are for the majority of our life, you know? But there's reasons for why women and men are different, why we respond differently to coaching philosophies. You know, having females show up, you need to start with really nurturing positive feedback. Most women, if they're honest, they're not going to respond well to negative, critical, screaming, that kind of thing from a coaching standpoint. They're going to want to learn. We're sponges. We want to learn. We want to improve. We want to connect with other women, connect with other male runners. But we also want to be able to feel like we're nurtured in the process of that feedback as well. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
It does. Absolutely. And Jenny, you know, one thing that I kind of empirically observed for a long time in running, and then I don't think I ever got an explanation. I don't know if you ever read the book Top Dog by Poe Bonson. And he talks about the difference between men and women just in terms of how they pair up, where men always like to work in a group, and it kind of goes back to evolutionary men hunting together. And then in the book they explain too how women always worked in pairs. You know, they never got into big groups, but in that pair, the competition was always kind of a delicate topic where one woman wouldn't want to be that much better than the person she paired up to. So one thing I had always noticed, just, you know, I time races for a living, that's what I do, and then, you know, we have a running group, is oftentimes you'll get two friends who will come to work out together, and they'll be on the track, or I'll see this in races, and they will simply run together the whole time, even though one is slightly better than the other. And, you know, I'll see it in races as well, where, you know, for Tristan, he's a faster runner than me, and I mean, if he ever slowed down to my pace in a 10K, I'd just be like, what are you doing? You know, why are you running next to me? You know, but for women, it's, you know, it's just something they do, because, like I said, there's this delicate balance, especially if they're friends, where it's like the other girl doesn't want to be 30 seconds ahead of her in a 5K. So they both kind of slow down, or, you know, and it's fascinating, but I never heard an explanation for that. And like I said, in the book Top Dog, she kind of breaks it down from an evolutionary, but I guess have you seen that as well?
Absolutely. Not only do we like to run with our girlfriends, we like to match what we're wearing as
Yeah.
So you'll see that on the race course too. We might have the same skirt sports, you know, skirt and top on, running together, you know, we're having a good old time, but it's really about helping the other, whether you're the stronger or the weaker. It's really about that cohesive energy in helping your girlfriend across the finish line. So much, hey, I really want to Boston, my girlfriend's a little bit slower. We train together. We've trained for 10 years together. The older of the two, I would encourage and empower that my girlfriend to go and do that, to run your own race on race day. And I think that's a really important. It's great to train with each other and great to have that friendship. But if you're really trying to make some improvements in your performance, race day, you know, go it on your own. And you may race at the same pace, and I might have a bad day. I'm going to feel bad, like you said. I'm going to feel badly if you hang with me and you're not trying to achieve your goal. Because when my girlfriend achieves her goal, I live vicariously through that. I'm motivated by that. It's inspiring and empowering and all of those things. So I think it's just kind of turning the dial on what that means on race day and kind of making that, having a healthy boundary with that.
Yeah, definitely agree. On the flip side, Jenny, when Tristan and I do workouts, like a marathon pace tempo run, he gives me a head start and then he tries to run me down. So that's kind of, I guess, how guys might be different.
that's a Mars Venus. Yep.
And then he hurls insults at me as he passes.
That's generally when the tears ensue there, Jenny.
That's when the crying begins.
That's hilarious.
So, Jenny, one of the things too I wanted to talk to you about is from a recovery standpoint. You said you come from the strength background, you know, flexibility, mobility, things like that, which are things that, you know, him and I have, I also personal trained. So that's, I come from a strength background, and I was actually into weightlifting before I got into running. So I've always, you know, really appreciated the strength element. And I feel like only recently have I started to I have a better understanding now than ever of how that plays in with the running and how it can make me a better runner. I think, you know, I've always kind of understood from a vanity's sake the purpose of weightlifting, but that doesn't always help you. That doesn't always help you. Exactly. That doesn't always help you become a better runner. That's what I would do. That's what I do in our runs, Jenny. Anyway, so how do you tie the strength training, the flexibility in with your clients' programs, and you know, how important is that? You know, from give us maybe a percentage standpoint. You know, I think one of the things that Simon and I always talk about is, you know, is it 90%, you know, you worry about running, and then, you know, is 10% to strength too much or not enough? Or, you know, I'm just throwing numbers out, but sure. You know, I mean, what do you think? How much should strength training be an emphasis, and how much do you emphasize it with your clients?
I come like from you, like you do, from a physical therapy, personal training background, exercise science background. So that is drilled in my head that balanced muscular strength and mobility, flexibility is vital. That's more important to me than having people run down the street. Because if you don't have a strong foundation, and things are, you start and your hip alignment's off and everything's off in your body and your kinetic chain, as you will, 5 miles down the road, you know what's going to happen. You might get through 3 months of training, but that fourth month, something's going to get off kilter, and then you're going to have the IT, and then it's going to transition to your foot. And it's so, so important to start with a strong foundation that if somebody comes to me and they're not doing strength training, I'll have them weave that in primarily first, and then kind of look at where are we going to go running wise, because you got to start here first. You got to have that sound, balanced body. I think it's different if you're training an athlete, let's say, to qualify for Boston or to do their first marathon. I think we need to look at the strength, at least I do, with my clients, look at how they're incorporating strength training from a seasonal standpoint. You look at a football player, for example, what they're doing preseason, they're not going to be able to do during the season because their bodies are basically pushing it every weekend in that game, and it's all about recovery and maintenance in between. So I think as athletes and runners in particular, especially now where people are doing so many races, that really need to have a preseason where you're not competing, and then that's where you focus on your foundation, your strength, your cross training, your flexibility, and all of that, and then weave that in, sprinkle that in during your season, and that's going to be different for everybody. Someone like yourself, if you're biomechanically enhanced and you're perfect and you don't have a lot of issues and you've got a solid foundation, your program might be lean more towards a maintenance, so you can get in some more 70 miles a week, that kind of thing, where somebody who really struggles biomechanically might do more cross training, might spend some more time building up that foundation of strength and have a lower volume of running. I think it depends on the person. It depends on how they run in general. Some of us can run 20 miles a week, and that's our threshold limit. Some of us can do 40. Some of us can do 80. But I think we, as trainers and coaches, I think we need to look at the person, the individual. Certainly, we can have a general guideline for pre-race season, pre-season training, in-season training, kind of experiment with what the volume is that works for you, and then post-season recovery. And those are the three seasons. If you're running a traditional model of marathon or half or 10K seasons, you need to have an off season, folks. I mean, there's so many folks out there, and I love the motivation. All that's great, and you're doing 50 marathons and 50 states and all that stuff. Fantastic. But at the end of reaching that goal, you need some serious recovery time. So kind of talking all over the place here. But yeah, I think the two things for strength training is you've got to make it seasonal, and you've got to tie it into who you are as an athlete and a runner.
Absolutely. One thing too, Jenny, that Simon and I are always fascinated by is you get people, and we have you know, people who come to us too and talk to us about this, and it's, you know, they want to run their first marathon, and you ask them about what their running background is, and they're like, oh, well, they don't really have one, you know, and it's like, well, when was the last time you raced? So I ran a 5K a few years ago. Have you ever run a 10K? No. Half marathon? No. But they want to run a full marathon, you know, and I love that. I love the desire, but at the same time, you want to be like, you know, let's build you up a little bit. Let's, you know, let's get some shorter stuff in there. You know, we don't need, you know, I think, you know, you look at, you know, a Runner's World magazine or something, and people see, you know, a 12-hour or a 12-week, you know, running program. And I know Runner's World doesn't advocate for jump off the couch and in 12 weeks we'll have you running a marathon. But I think you get people who look at that and think, I'm going to do that, you know, and they really are dealing with a lot of poor movement functions. They're not strong enough. It's, you know, their mechanics aren't very good. You know, when you get those kind of people, do you try to sit them down and like, hey, let's do a marathon next year, but you know, in 3 months, let's just get you through a really solid 10K. Or do you say, okay, I'll do my best to get you through to the finish line of a full.
But don't tell anybody.
Yeah. Don't post this on my website.
if I'm writing to somebody, I think it's a little bit different. I'll put out the options and it's their choice to, this is what I recommend. This is, if you were to do it, this is how you should do it kind of thing. But if I'm working with somebody and I, you know, some people decide not to work with me because of this, I will say, okay, it's great that you're coming off the couch. It's great that you've done a 5K. I love the fact that you want to do a half or a full, but we really need to invest in time and all the elements that we've been talking about and in building up that endurance, building up the mechanics, building up the strength, the time on your feet, all the things that are going to help you not only reach that finish line, but continue to do more of this in a healthful way. There's so many folks that, you know, I've seen train, they get that marathon done and then they stop running, and because it's painful and it's, you know, they have injuries and they made it through and they just made it through on race day, and it doesn't turn into a lifelong passion of activity and movement. You don't necessarily have to be a runner your whole life, but weaving that in or other activities for a lifetime is what this is all about. So yeah, I can't with good consciousness train someone who, you know, wants to do it in 10 weeks. I won't. I'll definitely say, this is the plan. If you want to work with me, it might take you a year, it might take you a year and a half, it might take you, you know, less time than that. It depends on you biomechanically, but this is the plan and it's going to be a while. And then also on top of that, you have the opportunity, this is kind of how I sell it, you have the opportunity to learn how to run maybe a 5K faster, a 10K, you know, what it's like to do a half marathon before you do your race day performance. You've got all these little opportunities to fine-tune your nutrition, to fine-tune your pacing skills, to deal with all those race day anxieties, all the things that are just like a performance on a stage. It's dress rehearsals. It's working through those bugs so that when you show up on that big day where you're toeing the line to do that marathon, you are set and you've got this, you know, mind of memories that and confidence behind you that you won't have if you just toe the line and do training in 10 or 12 weeks.
Yeah, I can tell. I think we attempt to do the same thing, and I think a lot of people are very receptive to that kind of instruction. And I think, you know, they do get it. I think most people get it, but you obviously have those people who still just they're gonna do the full with or without you. They're gonna figure out a way to get to the finish line. And it is. It's a shame because you're right. You do get. I actually have a close friend of mine who did not work with us. This was years ago, but he wanted to run a full, and he actually broke 3:30 in his first full. I mean, he's a really good athlete, but he destroyed himself doing it, and he hasn't run since. And I still try to convince him to just kind of slowly get back into it. But it's hard because you're right. You learn to. It can become something that you hate when you beat yourself up to the degree that some people do, and that's always a shame, I think. And obviously, you know, I think our desire would be to get people to not hate running, but love running, find out why we like it so much. So,
and it's, I mean, it's not that it's super easy if you spend the time, but it's a lot more enjoyable if you do invest that time. And I think a big part of it now is the social media. I mean, we didn't have Facebook 10 years ago. Yeah. So now you've got friends and people posting, hey, I'm going to do this race, and then I'm going to do that race, and I'm going to do this race, which is great.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lack of education and understanding of this is the process. It's not old school. It really is important. It's a high impact activity. It really is important to invest in building that foundation and skill level, both biomechanically and everything else, before you tackle this distance. Yeah, you can make it through it, but you know what's on the other side of that.
So true.
Yeah, you know, and Jenny, I think one thing with the popularity of running soaring, and you know, I kind of feel like marathons gotten this bucket list mentality where people just want to cross it off, and I think there's a lot of unfortunate side effects of that, because I'm sure a lot of people you deal with as well that we deal with, where they get in their mind that, oh, I just run marathons and half marathons, but they don't have a big racing background, you know, and those are people who are like, well, let's get you into some 5Ks, because there's, and people are just so afraid to kind of run something faster, but there's so much to be gained in running a 5K, just little things like, how do I get up in the morning, prepare myself, what do I eat for breakfast, what's not going to bother my stomach, what kind of shorts can I wear that don't give me chafing, you know, all these little things that you don't want to find out when you're running 26.2 miles.
Thanks for listening to Run Kahlo Training with Tristan Mitchell and Simon Escorcia. For more running tips to help you become a champion, check out our website, www.runkahlotraining.com.